I live in Red Lodge. I've been there for about 30 years, but I spent the summer of 1994 in Helena working for a software company. So it sort of feels like coming back to familiar territory for me today, especially being in a ponderosa forest, which is one of my favorite ecosystems. So we're going to talk a little bit about John Muir and Gifford Pinchot and preservation and conservation. I decided to write a book about Muir and Pinchot when I ran across an account of them camped together on Lake McDonald in what is now Glacier National Park. It just seemed like an interesting episode of Montana history, little known, with these nationally important figures interacting with our landscape. I didn't really know much about philosophy in general, or especially the philosophical debate that has been spawned by their apparent rivalry. I learned a little bit about it by learning about these two men, but I'm particularly excited to be here with Marisa today because she is a philosopher and comes at these issues from the angle of philosophy. So I'm hoping to learn, as well as you guys learn, by encouraging Marisa to talk a lot. She keeps encouraging me to talk a lot because I know a lot about Muir.
I talk
and
through asking questions, so it's all here. It's collective.
And I think we both would be eager for you guys to talk a lot as well. The great thing about philosophy and the humanities is that there are no correct answers. So, you know, there's no test at the end. This is just a chance for us to learn and think and ask. Okay, so that's sort of general. Everyone okay with what we're doing today? Any questions about that? I first want to talk about John Muir. Most of you have probably heard at least somewhat of John Muir. Famous especially for his relationship with Yosemite National Park, a protector of that landscape. He was also the co-founder of the Sierra Club, the nation's first grassroots environmental organization, which he started to protect those Sierra landscapes. He was also something of a political activist. I mean, he had to be in order to encourage protection of Yosemite and other places. And very much of a famous author. He arguably invented today's genre of nature writing. Do those folks want to come through here?
You're welcome to join us if you like. We're doing it, well, I guess you're on the bike, but philosophy.
Philosophy, bike and talk.
I'm guessing they're
in the middle of the... Oh, no, yeah, you're right.
Hey, check it. Quick talk. Yeah. So,
thank you. Good day.
No, chasing bikes. Muir's writing combined sort of descriptions of beautiful landscapes with memoir, with natural history, to describe how you would feel in nature, how he felt and how he wanted other people to feel. And those books have become classics and are still well known today. Muir was just a fascinating man. As good as the books are, he was apparently even better in person. As a speaker, as a storyteller, he was captivating. He had this Scottish brogue that would just sort of, the words would tumble out of him in perfect order. He actually struggled to make his writing as compelling as his speaking. So he was a frequent dinner guest at mansions all across California, where he lived most of his life, but also when he would visit New York or Boston. All the cultured people would want to have him tell his dog story, for example, Stikine, the story of the dog that he was hiking on a glacier with in Alaska, who he could actually see the dog's fear at jumping over a crevasse in a glacier, realizing that animals may have emotions just like we do, a radical view for that time. Muir had many views that were considered radical at the time, including his interpretation of Christianity, which was, less person-focused and more nature-focused, something that that Christians today are a little more comfortable with, but back then was something of a heresy. Muir had been born in Scotland, came at age 10 with his family to a farm in Wisconsin where his father worked him mercilessly. His father was a really strong religious believer, something of a conservative evangelical, and an evangelist, basically, trying to convert people to go to heaven through his teachings about religion. And Muir rejected his father's sort of joyless view of religion, but he did keep that evangelism, that evangelist personality. When he looked at people, he wanted to help them. He wanted them to live better, more fulfilling lives, and he believed they could do that through a richer connection to nature. And all of his books, all of his lobbying, all of his scientific efforts, he was also a great scientist. He was the first one to theorize that Yosemite Valley had been carved by a glacier. Those sheer cliffs of Half Dome, for example. Other people thought it must have been like an earthquake, a sudden cataclysm that had created this valley. And he said, no, look, it's a glacier. You can see, once you start thinking about it, you can really see that. And he was proved basically correct, whereas the leading scientists of the day were incorrect. But all of this effort, whether it was science or whether it was wandering, his favorite activity, just wandering through the woods for days with just a hunk of bread, no trails, no companions, no plan, just go. It was because he wanted to feel closer to God and nature, and he wanted other people to have that experience as well. And so he has to lobby to preserve open natural areas so that people can have those experiences. Let me see if I've covered everything I wanted to cover about them. Yosemite, Sierra Club, author, scientist, wanderer, immigrant, evangelist. The note of local interest is that in 1896, mid-July probably, a few days before now, he stayed in Helena, in a hotel somewhere near the railroad station. He didn't record much about the event. He simply, the following day when they got to Glacier, he said, boy, I like this a lot better than those hot, dry plains of Helena and to the north. So he wasn't that impressed with Helena, but at least he was here. Out of Muir's beliefs and teachings and activities came a philosophy that's known as preservation. The idea that our relationship to a landscape should be to preserve it so that other people, so that we can have a spiritual experience, a spiritual relationship to a higher power through this landscape, or just to this landscape if you're not into higher powers, and so that other people can have those spiritual relationships as well. If you're going to preserve this landscape, that means you don't want to touch it, right? You're not going to mine or log or maybe even graze, because you want to keep it the way it is. There gets to be a sort of a sense that humans are separate from nature. Nature is divine. Nature is perfect. But when we humans come along, we keep mucking stuff up. And so negotiating that divide is something that we want to strive for while keeping that divide there, because otherwise we would screw it up. The National Park Service was founded a couple years after Muir died. Muir was born, I believe, 1838, died in 1914. And although the first park, Yellowstone, was founded in 1872 and a couple more after that, the first time that they established an organization to manage all these parks, the National Park Service, was in 1916. And it was something of a response. Yeah, come on through, folks, if you want.
We're waiting on a couple.
Okay. something of a response to Muir's death and sort of honoring him, honoring his legacy through that philosophy that we often see in parks of, you know, well, don't get off the boardwalk, don't touch this, don't take anything, don't mess up this wonderful natural place. That's sort of my brief amateur summarization of a preservation philosophy, but can you tell me about how you encounter?
Yeah, well, and mine was maybe wanting to pose this as a question. So when I think of this idea of humans being separate from nature, I think one of the questions you posed when we were creating the video was, are humans separate from an inferior or part of nature? And so I'm kind of curious, I mean, it definitely sounds like with Muir's background, maybe he strayed a little bit, but the separate was, I think, something that existed a lot in my understanding of various forms of Christianity. But the inferior is one that seems separate from a lot of, like Aristotle definitely had humans on the hierarchical scale. So I guess one question within this would be, where did he get the human being inferior aspect to the rest of this, to the rest of nature?
Again, I'm going to defer to anyone who has better knowledge of history and philosophy than I do. But I think, yeah, you know, in the Bible, you see a lot of nature is here for humans. But especially with the Romantic movement, William Wordsworth and some of those poets in England and in Europe in the early 1800s, I believe, they sort of reversed that. And they said, boy, you know, if God created everything, then look at this magic, look at this beauty we have in nature, and look at some of this ugly stuff we have in humanity, and maybe, you know, maybe it actually is reversed, and maybe the nature is the good thing, is the more important, more pure expression of God's love.
So one thing that comes up, and I'd welcome some thoughts from you guys, is this idea, my understanding of preservation as its practice is there's an idea that nature as this beautiful thing that we're either part of or separate from. I tend to lean toward the part of, but also I love the preservation idea, that there being in nature is valuable in itself. Like it's this beautiful thing that has value, that it's sort of separate from us. So I'm wondering in the preservation philosophy if there's, at least in Muir's approach, if he leaves any room for the extrinsic value, meaning like the utility or the use aspect, what we can get from nature as well, in your readings, if he left room for that.
That's a great contrast, and I think one we want to highlight throughout the day today is nature a holistic thing? When we talk about nature, we mean just sort of all the trees and the animals and the ecosystems and all of their interactions and all of the spiritual benefits you gain from observing those interactions? Or is it also, or maybe alternatively, is it resources? Is it grass that that animals can eat and timber that we can use to build our houses or heat our homes or cook our food? Is it, you know, is it minerals that we can use in productive ways? And as I understand it, the preservation philosophy, as articulated by Muir's disciples and followers through the 20th century, has said, no, 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 none of that resource stuff. We got to focus on the holistic. Because you can never, I mean, you could put a price tag on the timber and on the grazing and on all these other things, and yet those prices would never add up to the value we get from the thing holistically. So preservation has real problems with, would you call it the extrinsic values of resources? To me, Muir himself was probably okay with that. He understood that the trees could go to serve as fencing materials. In his book, Our National Parks, he talked about the wonder of the lodgepole pine and its ability to be used for fences or for teepees and whatnot. Also the wonder of the Douglas fir, which was so big and strong for ships' masts. And as he was talking about these wondrous trees, he was talking about their uses. So yeah, I think he could see a mix. And I think it is only people who later on were trying to articulate a philosophy, maybe at an extreme, in order to differentiate it from another philosophy, that they said, stop talking about resources. Appreciate nature as a whole.
I'm curious what you guys think, if there's anything that stands out to you as there being a practical or, generally speaking, pragmatic approach to approaching nature in the way that Muir does, if you guys have any thoughts. Yeah, Marie.
Well, it seems that preservationists want to set aside some parts that we never touch, but then, yeah, we'll just trash this other part. And so, again, I think there's a flaw in the preservationist thinking, because, again, like you mentioned, it excludes us as a part of that system. And what is our role in that system? Wendell Berry said, you know, there's no unsacred lands. It's all sacred. We've just ruined some. So I wonder if there's a pendulum between the more Christian view of we're dominant to we're inferior, and maybe in this time in history we're coming to the center of it and saying, what is our role of give and take to the system?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. And I suspect that when we start moving into Pinchot and looking at some of that contrast, some of that will attempt to be blended together a bit.
I'd love to hear other people's perspectives. Yeah.
I've had a thought. I had the pleasure of working at Glacier Park for a year on environmental projects and got to know the mission of the Park Service compared with the Forest Service or like a wilderness area. And so the Forest Service is growing crops, trees, and the wilderness is truly protected. And the Park Service was more about balancing the natural resources and preserving them, but being a place where people could experience those things and appreciate them. So that was really it's a struggle to balance, because you'd be in a meeting with biologists and park rangers, and there's a lot of heated discussions, but it was pretty cool.
You know, I kind of think that, you know, we have to exploit nature to a certain extent, because all these plants and bugs around here are busy exploiting their surroundings for their own good and surviving. Just that we're so damn good at it.
We're a really large parasite.
We overdo it. And we have to somehow, I'm not sure what you call it, but we see, you know, limit our own, don't limit our brain power, but limit perhaps our technology so that we can exploit, but not do it so destructively. And,
limit the negative aspects of our footprint and
yeah,
try to.
Yeah, you know, but we have to walk. We have to make footprints somehow, somewhere. We can't, you know, we're doing it right here. This is trail,
right.
But we have to. I think the biggest. I'm not a philosopher either, but I think the biggest philosophical problem I personally worry about is where do we stop with our expertise at exploiting? You know, I'll shut up.
Well, that's a well-planned point. You got to draw the line.
Yep.
But I think there's common sense of using the natural resources so they're sustainable. You know, you'll have a recovery of whatever you're growing. Growing is a big thing. The more mining gets a little bit, they do destroy the surface there. And I don't know, there's a movement to reclaim that, but that the technology is getting where it is destructive from the that lasts a long time.
Yeah, this idea of sustainability is good, but you got to figure out exactly what that means.
We're going to talk a lot about sustainability at our next stop with Pinchot. I don't want to totally cut you off, but I wondered. I think there was another comment over here.
Well, it's just kind of a practical. God is timeless, and the glaciers moved and made the mountains here in the Northwest, which is beautiful. What if I lived in sub-Saharan Africa or North Dakota? You know, just somewhere where there's just not much going on in terms of natural resources above the ground. So it's just a, you know, I mean, it, so we're talking, it's just a, we're talking about men and, or humans and nature living together, and who's on top, who's on bottom, who's the, you know, middle. And then there's other parts of the world and timeless that, would this be a conversation? And because God is timeless, it's kind of the balance of thought.
You bring up two things that I find very, very interesting there. One is this notion of how do other cultures do it? Is this something that we're just doing here? And the other was, you thought it was a slip of the tongue, but it wasn't. These are all men we're talking about. And these are all white Protestant men we're talking about. And so I think it's valuable to understand how they viewed the world so that we can help understand the world we have today. But let's also think about women, minorities, other ways of viewing the world are probably, hopefully, going to shape the world we have tomorrow. There's a comment in the back.
So there are at least two big differences between how humans live and how turkeys make use of the resources. But humans use external sources of energy. Sort of unbound in two ways that most other creatures aren't, because we can harness these enormous gasoline engines or whatever, and there's nothing constraining our growth the way, you know, a deer would be constrained by a predator or lack of grassland.
And I wonder whether that's one of the things that fascinated Muir about wandering into the Sierra alone was the danger of, you know, and I think there were still grizzly bears in the Sierra while he was alive and wandering there. So he might have actually had a predator and felt more like some of the other
predators. We didn't live to be 80, 90 years old, that type of thing. Then we had, you know, it's been the 1900s and on that we have really, and I could have that historically wrong, but my thought is this is a fairly new phenomenon, but of course what we have been able to do in that short amount of time is amazing, and so I wonder how that kind of plays into the whole cycle.
Yeah, I mentioned the Romantic poets earlier, and I think they were very much responding to the Industrial Revolution in England. And maybe Muir is doing some of that here as well. You know, he had, after he grew up in Wisconsin, he was, the other thing about Muir I forgot to mention, he was a genius scientifically, engineering-wise. He was an inventor. He invented machines to do things on factory floors. And so he had a job for a while in Minneapolis running this factory floor because he could set up all the machines. And one day there was a malfunction, something broke, and a piston came and hit him in the eye and blinded him for a week or two. And during the course of that blindness, that's when he decided, I don't want to bother with industry. I want to devote myself to nature. And so he took off from Indianapolis and walked south. His idea was he wanted to go to the Amazon because famous scientists explorers had gone there. And so he was going to walk down to Florida and then find a boat. So 1,000 miles through relatively uninspiring landscapes. In 1867, just 2 years after the end of the Civil War, when there were still a lot of tensions blooming, and he's just walking around looking at all the trees and the plants. Get me away from industry, get me away from war, let me focus on nature. This has been a really good discussion so far.
Yeah, and I think we'll make our way to our next one as we sort of transition into the sort of competing environmental philosophy, at least this time through Pinchot, when we'll look at conservation.
But as you walk,
Yes.
I encourage you to try to experience this as if you were John Muir. Imagine yourself being John Muir walking through these landscapes. How would you experience the setting differently? How does it change your relationship to nature, to society? What would happen if everybody had that attitude?